Had a coat of arms, I think I would have these words chiselled upon it. Virtue is the only nobility. That's according to Sir Charles Nicholson, who's the subject of my next discussion. And you'll discover down the track that virtue is the only nobility was a very clever choice of words. Sir Charles is one of these blokes who came out to Australia during the early days of settlement, around the mid-1830s, and made substantial contributions to this country, including the fact that he was one of the co-founders of the first university in Australia, that being the University of Sydney. He helped establish a number of museums. He bequeathed a rather large, and I must say, fine collection of antiquities to the Nicholson Museum, named after him, of course, and he was involved in the politics of his country, a huge landowner, made a lot of money, and was perhaps the first of Australia's grand philanthropists. This is also one of those rags-to-riches story, but with a slight twist. We didn't know about the rags part of Sir Charles' life until recently. In a sense, it's like unwrapping a mummy when you think about the term rags. The sleuth, the unwrapper, who has discovered the real identity of Australia's great patron, is Michael Turner. And Michael is senior curator at the Nicholson Museum, and he joins me in the Sydney studio, which is a change because I'm often joining him in his Nicholson Museum. Welcome, welcome, Michael. Let's begin with what Sir Charles did for the wide brown land. I've mentioned a few areas. Tell us his other claims to fame.
Well, he came out here in the early 1830s. And a couple of years after arriving, inherited a great deal of money from an uncle who was out here who died. And he used the money, he didn't gamble and drink and spend it on loose women. He actually spent it on good deeds. He was involved from the very beginning with the Mechanics Institute. He helped set up a museum for the Mechanics Institute. He was one of the first members of the medical board. He was involved in the setting up of a railway company, the Gaslight Company. And then on slightly bigger things, the founding of the Australian Museum, what became the Mitchell Library, what became the Royal Society, the Botanical Gardens.
What did he do on his days
what didn't
off?
He do?
Yes. What a splendid fellow. No wonder he became a baronet. And he's Australia's first hereditary baronet.
Yes.
How did that happen?
Well, three times he was Speaker of the Legislative Council, and he was knighted as a result, following his appointment for the third time. And then in 1858, following his retirement, he was appointed Australia's, as you say, first baronet, and he styled himself Sir Charles Nicholson of Luddenham, out near Penrith.
Now, this is a pretty senior gong, isn't it? If you look at the sort of the Debrett's hierarchy, he's right up the top of the list with this, with his knighthood, his baronetcy.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, to put it in perspective, I mean, a baronet is the lowest level of peerage. It was hereditary, so his son became Sir Charles following him. The only one thing he didn't get was a seat in the House of Lords. But to put it in its perspective, as you say, he was the first, so it was, in fact, very significant.
So, was he a nice fellow, do you know? Was he a charming, avuncular, warm and cuddly, was he insufferably pompous?
He was enormously high-achieving. He certainly seemed to get his own way. And the only real hint we get to the man he was was from his family. He married when he went back to England in his late 50s. And from what we learned from his wife and from his three sons and from reactions following his death, he does seem to have been universally very popular.
I understand, however, that there are mysteries within mysteries. Now, let's start moving towards that. Indeed, dear listener, Sir Charles may not have been Charles at all. And the name that you've come up with, which we'll get to later, would be even better, I think, on a museum, particularly one of antiquities. It has a certain biblical ring.
Absolutely, absolutely.
You're not intending to change it, though, are you?
Well, the Asquithian Museum maybe doesn't have quite the same ring as the Nicholson Museum.
Okay. Well,
people are just getting used to it.
So he did lots for Australia, and he gets this gong. And before you started your meticulous research, what was known about his earlier life? What was believed to be known about it?
Well, it was believed, and I mean, this is, as you'll find in the Australian Dictionary of Biography and in other papers, works that were done on him in the 1900s, it was said that he was born in Cockermouth, which is a market town in the north of the Lake Districts in England, that he was educated at home following the death of his parents. He was orphaned. It was said that his father had been the agent for the Egremont Estates in Cumberland, which was a very high position. In the absence of the Duke, the agent was all-powerful. It was said that his mother came of a very good family in Beedale in Yorkshire, and that his father's background went back mercantile, wealth, and so on. And this is what we had been led to believe.
Well, led to believe, and now you're leading us in another direction. Why were you suspicious that there was a deep secret?
Well, 3 years ago now, I decided to put on an exhibition in the museum to celebrate the 200th anniversary of the birth of Nicholson in 1808, and to tie it in with the 150th anniversary of the Nicholson Museum this year, 2010. So I started doing more research on him. And in fact, I went back to Cockermouth to try and trace the family. And in fact, it's an area I'm from myself. I come from the Lake District in England, so I have this sort of spiritual affinity with the man, or I thought I did anyway. And I became rather nonplussed when I went through the records, and I went to the records office up in Cumberland, and I could find no record of a Charles Nicholson having been born. I could find no record of a Charles Nicholson father. And indeed, as was pointed out to me, it would be very odd to have somebody at that time in that area even called Charles, because there were still memories of the Jacobite rebellions. And it would be a bit like calling your son Adolf, perhaps. So I became a little suspicious.
Or John after John Kerr. So, okay, so Charles is an odd name for the time and place. Yeah.
No. So it where to look next became the problem. And the only hint we had was that when he returned to England in 1862, he went back in his late 50s, never came back to Australia, and lived through to his 90s. He died eventually in 1903. The only official records we had were the censuses he filled in that were held every 10 years in England. So I had four censuses for him, and on those he listed his place of birth. Now, of course, he thought he was all right, because supposedly you couldn't access censuses for 100 years. So he felt that maybe he could say where he was actually born. On one of them, he put Beedale in Yorkshire. Two, he put Whitby, which is over on the coast of Yorkshire. And on one, he put a tiny little village called Slights, which is 2 or 3 miles outside Whitby. So the fact that Whitby was there twice and Slights was there led me to believe that quite possibly his origins lay over there. So that's where I decided to go looking.
And what did you find when you looked?
Well, for 18 months, I didn't find anything. And then I'd put a post on on the web, on a message board, for the his mother's family. His mother's maiden name was Asco. And I put a post saying, does anybody know anything about this man? But, you know, Charles Nicholson, son of Barbara Asco. Nothing. Until last October. When I got an email from a woman called Janet Gate informing me that her husband was the great-great-great-grandson of Charles Nicholson. We had thought the line had actually died out, that there were no surviving members of the family. So this was shock number one. Secondly, she informed me that she herself had been trying to track information on the family for some 25, 30 years. even together with Nicholson's grandson, the last baronet, Sir John Nicholson. And no luck. They'd been looking, like me, over in the Cockermouth area.
Right.
Then I decided to go over to England in January. I was already heading over that way to do some other research. So I decided to meet up with Janet. And then 2 weeks before I left, I contacted a museum in Whitby, because along with the research I was doing, I found that the uncle who had left Nicholson all his money, who had died a couple of years after Nicholson had got here, his wife had donated some material to this museum in Whitby, Aboriginal spears and shields and so on. And so I'd contacted them to say, listen, do you know anything about William Ayscough? Would you by any miracle still happen to have the artifacts that were donated? And would you have any information about them? This was all tangential to the research. And I got an email back from the keeper of ethnography in the museum. They're saying, well, believe it or not, I'm actually doing research myself on the uncle, William Ayscough, who was Nicholson's uncle. We have the objects. They're on the wall here in the museum. So suddenly I was getting all these loose ends were coming together. And indeed, the people over there actually started doing some research for me as well in the village of Slides, and found the grave of Nicholson's mother.
And what you've discovered is that basically this extraordinary fellow, well, it's a Cinderella story, isn't it? Because he's the bastard grandson of a farm labourer.
He is indeed the bastard grandson of a farm labourer, because we had been led to believe that the grandparents were a wealthy family in Beedale. But in fact, sitting in the records office in North Allerton in North Yorkshire, I had before me the records for this tiny little church and the even smaller chapel of the wonderfully named Uggle Barmby just outside Slights. The two were joined together, that had the christening records, the baptismal records for Nicholson's mother, his uncle and aunts. And then, indeed, I found the burial records for them all as well. And there was that wonderful moment when I came across, I'd found all the uncles and aunts, and I found the mother, Barbara. And then I found on exactly the right date the birth of Nicholson II, Barbara Ayscough, spinster, born as an illegitimate son. But what came as the greatest shock, of course, is that his name wasn't Charles, and indeed, being unmarried, nor was it Nicholson.
I think this is the name I was thinking about that would look good over the doorway of your museum, is Isaac. That does connect, I think.
It does, it does.
With antiquity rather than Charles.
Isaac Ayscough. But what is very interesting that I found in the area as well, I noticed that biblical names were given to illegitimate children. That, in fact, ordinary children were Charles, Henry, Roberts.
But why Charles, given that it did have a bit of a cloud over it?
Well, here becomes the bit that we don't know. We know now everything about his mother, his mother's family, and about his birth. The mystery still is to exactly who was his father. Now, we have several leads that we're working on at the moment, and indeed I'm going back to England in July for 6 weeks to do more research on this, as well as a holiday. But there is more to be still to be found out.
Now, let's look at this wonderful phrase, virtue is the only nobility. This comes from, well, it comes from Juvenal's satire, doesn't it? Of what value are pedigrees, which goes on to talk about how with noble families, the nobility usually runs out after a few generations, but it is the common man who goes on to do noble acts. So in choosing this, he knew what it really meant.
He did. It's absolutely fascinating, this, as an insight into the man. It, as you say, it's one of Juvenal's satires, number 8. And It's a satire about, in part, you don't have to be noble to do good things. But also, and in a way offset against that, is the fact that what right have the nobility to presume to do what they do, given purely their name?
It's interesting that this connects to his friend Wentworth, who also worked with him on establishing the University of Sydney, because Wentworth was a driving force in what was called the Bunyip aristocracy, you know, pushing for hereditary aristocrats in Australia.
Yeah, even though he was illegitimate himself. I mean, his mother was a convict.
Dear. So you haven't been able to find out for certain who his father is. What about him winning Lotto? How did it happen that he suddenly has this vast fortune dumped on him?
Again, there's another twist story, things that to discover in there. His uncle, William Ayscough, who was the brother of his mother, had been running convict ships out to Australia, and we know a lot about him. We know the names of the ships and when they came. He was an extensive landowner himself in and around Sydney. Solomon Wiseman was a great friend, and many of these characters were busy carving up the land for themselves. It was Ayscough, the uncle, who persuaded Nicholson to come out here. He'd qualified as a doctor at Edinburgh University, and given his lack of pedigree, it was the obvious thing to come out here to lose himself, to reinvent himself.
Right. Well, at some point, you tell me that he owned about half of Queensland.
Indeed he did. Initially he backed Leichhardt's exhibition up north. Leichhardt named Mount Nicholson after him. There's a Nicholson River up that way as well. And, of course, the great thing with these explorers is that their benefactors, they would be tipping off where there was land to buy.
Michael, perhaps he went back to England, perhaps for some sort of fear of exposure?
Yes, I mean, it's interesting. It's not till the late 1850s that he chooses to go back. So he's been out here for 25 years. He has no surviving direct family at all in England. And even when he finally goes back in 1862, it's almost as if the coast is clear. He can go back as a Renaissance man, completely reinvented as a
baronet.
He's
been laundered, hasn't he?
Yeah.
God heavens. How did he get this eye for antiquities, among other things? Because he was a very cultured gentleman.
Well, again, it's very interesting. He goes back in the 1850s, having founded the university. He's chancellor of the university by this time. And he decides there's one thing missing, which is they have rebuilt Oxford and Cambridge out here in Camperdown. They've given it a motto that, the same mind under different stars. And he feels that there's one thing still lacking, and that's a good dose of old European culture. So he goes back shopping in Europe to bring back antiquities. He goes to Egypt, he goes to Italy. He is an Egyptologist himself. He published extensively his Greek and Roman antiquities. Basically, he was going down to the flea markets in Rome on a Sunday afternoon and buying job lots. And we've got some good stuff, we've got some bad stuff.
But even the bad stuff is interesting.
No, this is what makes it so fascinating, because the whole concept of good and bad is fascinating. You go to modern museums and it's full of so-called good stuff, art, historically beautiful pieces. And really what we're really interested in is the more mundane, and that is the absolute beauty of part of what Nicholson was collecting. We have a far more representative collection as a result.
You've got a Horace. I've got a Horace, you've got a Horace.
We do. Nicholson acquired four mummies for the museum, and one of them is a child, an eight-year-old boy, as we know now. For over 100 years we thought it was a girl. And yes, he's one of our star attractions.
You're the senior curator. Do you have a favourite piece, Michael?
Now, this is a really interesting question, because on the
one
hand...
When people ask me this, I must say, it depends on your mood, really.
Well, it does depend on the mood. It depends on what would actually fit inside your house. There's a 6-ton column capital for Hathor, which I love passionately. But
I saw you trying to
get
it in the back of the Mini. Okay, failing that.
failing that, no, I don't. It does change all the time, as you say. It depends on moods. It's like being in a toy shop, being curator of a museum. There are so many beautiful objects one can admire, one can lust over. But what more important is you find out more about things. You find out the history of it, and this adds another level to them, another level of appreciation, another level of interest, beyond the fact that they are just an Egyptian shabti or a Greek pod.
Yeah, it's interesting. People think that a museum piece, once it's there, is sort of, that's it. It becomes a museum piece. But that's not true. It's still on a journey, isn't it?
Yes.
And curators and scholars come and go and keep not so much chipping away at it, but adding to it.
It is. It's exactly that. The different levels, the different interests that people have. We see this in visitors that come. It's a very, you know, how to engage with people. You have a scholar on one level who is interested in tombs and stratigraphy and so on. You have other people who will come and they're interested to know that Agatha Christie happened to clean a particular piece and write about it in her diaries.
You do have fun in this job, don't you, Michael?
Oh, yes, I do.
Is that your real name, incidentally?
I'm sorry?
Is Michael your real name? Am I sitting here with a real Michael Turner?
It might be. At the moment it is.
Anyway, look, happy 150th. How are you celebrating this splendid occasion?
We're going to be having October and November are going to be the time when we're going to be celebrating anniversary. There's a launch of a book that we've been working on. Because there's not only the Nicholson Museum, of course, we have the Maclay Museum of Ethnography, historical instruments and photographs and so on. And we also have the art gallery, the art collection, which is very significant. And so the three of us together are celebrating the 150th. Nicholson began it.
It's a cornucopia.
It's going to be just the most
fantastic,
wonderful time.
Yeah. Well, Michael, thank you very much for popping in and unwrapping, not the mummy, but... the good old fella, old Charles, and that's been a tonic. Thank you, Michael Turner, senior curator of the Nicholson at the University. And you can find more out about Charles at the current exhibition, Nicholson, Man and Museum. That's it for the week. But don't forget Classic on Friday. Oh, and on Easter Monday, I'm having a nice cosy chat with Australian writer and one of our foundation feminists, Kate Jennings. Good on your team, Chris Short, Sasha Fegan, Umrutha Slee, Lila Schooner, Paul Goff and Kate McDonald. That's it for now. Stick around for the news on Radio National. Oh, and have a terrific time over Easter. And make sure you put little Easter eggs all around the garden.